This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, how West Bank villagers are resisting settler attacks and land theft. Life is, quote, no longer bearable in Syria, says a Palestinian refugee now in Egypt. Plus, journalist not found. The museum in Washington, D.C. expunges Palestinian journalists murdered by Israel from its website. We'll have an interview with journalist and author Max Blumenthal about his exposé on the Oslo Freedom Forum founders' ties to Islamophobes who inspired mass killer Anders Breivik.
So we did a report for EI about this group that was clearly being put forward to kind of create a wedge in the Muslim community and undermine mainstream Muslim organizing, also to take Palestine off the table.
News from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, including renowned physicist Stephen Hawking pulling out of a conference in Israel at the urging of Palestinian colleagues. And the Oberlin College Student Senate passes a divestment resolution. Plus, poetry by Remy Kanazi on the Nakba, honoring his grandmother who was expelled from Palestine by Zionist militias in 1948. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland. We begin in the West Bank. The Electronic Intifada's contributor Andrew Beal reported this week from the village of Deir Jarir. Residents of that village and nearby Silwad have been holding weekly demonstrations against the expansion of the adjacent settlement colony of Ofra and its decades-old satellite, Amona. The villagers have not only endured ongoing land theft and violent attacks by settlers, but the Israeli government has taken most of the groundwater and has rerouted it to the settlements, according to a village official. Beal reported that, quote, almost 2 months ago, settlers from Amona tried to establish a new outpost in the hills between Deir Jarir and Silwad. They completed construction on one building before local youths burned it down, sparking price tags attacks from settlers, who burned 10 cars in Deir Jarir, destroyed dozens of olive trees, and beat a 60-year-old man unconscious as he worked in his field. The report adds that Palestinian protesters have begun using bulldozers, a vehicle usually seen across Palestine driven by Israeli soldiers to raise Palestinian land and homes, for a different purpose. The residents are clearing a path for vehicles to reach olive groves, making it easier for farmers to access their fields. Beal added that the path will also provide an escape route for people running from Israeli soldiers and settlers when they inevitably attack the next demonstration. Demonstrator and Deir Jarir resident Ibrahim Bakar said that the unarmed demonstrations are an offensive move, a show of strength and solidarity to stop the settler attacks. Quote, we're here to prove that this land is ours, and we're here to protect it, that's all. We're not here to attack anybody, he said. This is our land. It's been our land for the last 2,000 years. Those were excerpts of a longer report by Andrew Beal. For much more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. Reporting from Cairo, our correspondent Rami Al-Maghari reported this week on the situation for Palestinian refugees fleeing the civil war in Syria. Al-Maghari writes, quote, one of the most distressing scenes that Redwan Amaira witnessed in Syria was that of a woman being shot as she carried some bread. After warplanes hit Yarmouk, a Palestinian refugee camp near Damascus last November, Amaira decided to flee. A 60-year-old teacher employed with the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, Amaira had just registered with the Palestinian Authority's embassy in Cairo. It is not the first time that his family has been uprooted. They were forced to leave Safed, a town in the Galilee region of historic Palestine, when it was attacked by Zionist forces in 1948. Amaira flew to Cairo last month following a period of displacement within Syria. Al-Maghari reported that each day the Palestinian Authority's embassy in Cairo receives about 20 Palestinian refugees from Syria. Those were excerpts of a longer report by Rami Al-Maghari in Cairo. For much more on the story, visit electronicintifada.net. The Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima reported this week that after caving in to intense Israel lobby pressure, Washington, D.C.'s Newseum has removed the names of two Palestinian journalists from its memorials for journalists killed while doing their jobs. The journalists, Hussam Salama and Mahmoud Al-Kumi, were extrajudicially executed by Israeli occupation forces in the Gaza Strip last November. The personal pages for the journalists on the museum website now say simply, "Journalist not found," and their pictures and details have been taken down. The museum has refused to answer Abunima's questions about its decision-making process regarding the two men. Meanwhile, Palestinian journalists and a member of Al-Kumi's family have spoken out against the museum's cave-in in a video report by the Real News Network. Islam Al-Kumi, Mahmoud's brother, said, quote, "The museum's decision not to include the names of Palestinian journalists who were killed at the hand of the Israeli occupation forces by American-made warplanes during the eight-day war on Gaza was a slap in the face. They dare to take this decision because of Israeli pressure," he added, urging the museum to reverse course. Yusuf Al-Ostaz of the Palestinian Journalists Syndicate said, quote, "We received the museum's decision with great disappointment," saying it reflected a double standard. "The killings of Salama and Al-Kumi were part of a wave of deliberate Israeli attacks against Palestinian journalists and media organizations during the Israeli assault that Human Rights Watch investigated and said amounted to war crimes." As the Electronic Intifada reported earlier this week, Cliff May, the president of the neocon think tank Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, threatened that his organization would pull its annual conference from the museum because the Palestinians were named among more than 2,000 journalists killed while performing their work. And as Mondo Weiss also reported, the campaign to pressure the museum picked up last weekend with both the Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Committee chiming in. Human Rights Watch found no evidence to support Israeli claims that the men were engaged in anything resembling terrorist activity. They were riding in their car, returning from filming the injured at Gaza City's Ashifa Hospital when Israeli forces extrajudicially executed them. Despite this, the museum said in a statement last week that it had, quote, "decided to reevaluate their inclusion as journalists on our memorial wall, pending further investigation." But the deletion of Salama and Al-Kumi's names from the website suggests the decision has been made and implemented. Those were excerpts of a longer story by Ali Abunima. For more on this story, visit our Lobby Watch blog at electronicintifada.net. The Electronic Intifada has published a new exclusive investigation by Max Blumenthal on the Oslo Freedom Forum, a human rights conference billed as, quote, "a three-day summit exploring how best to challenge authoritarianism and promote free and open societies." Our report brings forth evidence that Thor Halvorsen, the founder of the Oslo Freedom Forum, receives significant funding from the same financiers who support the Islamophobes who inspired anti-Muslim Norwegian mass killer Anders Behring Breivik. Despite being presented with this evidence, the Norwegian government and Amnesty International are embracing Halvorsen, a longtime far-right activist and the scion of a politically connected family tied to Venezuela's U.S.-backed opposition. Joining us to talk about this article is journalist and author Max Blumenthal. He joins us from the New York area. Max, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Yeah, great to be on with you.
So first, lay out what was uncovered in this extensive investigation. This is a multi-layered expose on what you call the Islamophobia industry's financial network.
Yeah, we uncovered some remarkable things that that were unfamiliar to me, because you know you associate the Islamophobia industry with a small kind of coterie of funders and activists who are very open about their opinions. But we found some more insidious groups who are playing a still effective role in pushing what I consider to be kind of a right-wing reactionary agenda. And it started when I saw the interfaith ceremony after the Boston bombings. It was nationally televised. Barack Obama spoke there, and the Muslim representative was supposed to be Imam Suhaib Webb, who is one of the foremost Islamic religious figures in the country. And he was replaced at the last second with someone named Nasser Weddadi, who's like a Mauritanian internet activist who has really no, he's unknown in the Muslim community, works for a group called the American Islamic Congress. And I looked into who they were, got their funders, realized they were funded by people like Sheldon Adelson, the Bradley Foundation, which is a right-wing foundation behind Daniel Pipes and the whole Islamophobia industry. They had Zudi Jasser, who testified at Peter King's hearing on their board. So we did a report for EI about this group that was clearly being put forward to kind of create a wedge in the Muslim community and undermine mainstream Muslim organizing, also to take Palestine off the table. This is a group that was heavily involved in promoting the Iraq War and received grants from the Bush administration, still receives grants from the Obama administration. And then it rolled into this next investigation on the Human Rights Foundation, which is this kind of shadowy human rights group run by a figure named Thor Halvorsen, who's he's a Venezuelan oligarch. He's the son of an oligarchic family heavily connected to the Venezuelan anti-Chavez opposition. I went to college with him at the University of Pennsylvania. He was a right-wing activist there, ran the conservative paper, which published all kinds of borderline racist, anti-feminist, anti-gay articles, continued conservative activism after college, and then rolled it into this Human Rights Foundation, which he's been using kind of to whitewash the Venezuelan opposition, to whitewash all sorts of neoconservative figures and himself by bringing legitimate human rights defenders together with neoconservatives, with right-wing radical libertarians like PayPal founder Peter Thiel, who openly, he says he opposes democracy. The Norwegian press calls it the washing machine. But it's co-sponsored by the Norwegian government. It's co-sponsored by Amnesty International. And what we did at EI was to investigate its funders. We found that it shares the same funding network as the Islamophobia industry, as the American Islamic Congress, that Nasser Widadi from the American Islamic Congress was being flown out, junketed out to Norway, along with Ahmed Ben Chemsi, who's the co-founder with Widadi of Free Arabs, which says that it was sponsored by the American Islamic Congress, and so there they are, having this human rights extravaganza that Thor Halvorsen calls the Davos of human rights. No one knows that he was a longtime right-wing activist. No one knows what his agenda is. And the Norwegian government seems to think that it's sort of just this benign event designed to connect human rights defenders around the world, when it's really anything but that. And it's partly about regime change. It's partly about whitewashing sordid figures who are representing the oligarchic class in Venezuela. And it's also, just generally speaking, about the right-wing neoconservatives and libertarians co-opting the human rights cause and gaining control of it. One of the things they're going to do when they gain control of it is gradually force Palestine off the table. And a lot of the people who participated in this conference seem pretty comfortable with that.
Max, talk a little bit more about what these investigations tell us about the structure and influence of these types of organizations that fund the worldwide Islamophobia industry.
I mean, there are definitely less than 10 foundations who are at the core of this Islamophobia industry. And what we found in our investigation, in this two-part investigation, is maybe less than 5. And there are really less than 20 key Islamophobic figures. And they've managed to have a massive impact on American culture and on Europe, which is having a much harder time assimilating Muslim immigrants, partly because they just don't have an immigrant culture. They don't have an immigrant tradition like the United States. And so in Norway, I mean, Oslo is the site of Anders Breivik, the far-right Islamophobic terrorist's murderous rampage. He attacked Oslo's government, main government building, and he attacked a youth camp run by the governing Labour Party because he blamed these people. He called them cultural Marxists or multiculturalists, and he blamed multiculturalism for destroying Europe for allowing Muslim immigrants in. This is, by the way, the same rhetoric we heard from conservative campus organizers like Thor Halvorsen. And what Breivik left is a 1,500-page manifesto outlining his influences And it's just basically a compendium of the writings of all the figures produced by the Islamophobia industry, who are funded by the Bradley Foundation, who are funded by the Donors Capital Fund. And these are the two of the main funders of the Human Rights Foundation, which is behind the Oslo Freedom Forum. So we found, you know, that this network stretches further beyond anything we imagined before. And it's gained the cooperation of the Norwegian government, which suffered these attacks from an Islamophobic terrorist. And we thought this was shocking. So Ali, the publisher of EI, Ali Abu Nima, called the Norwegian government. The foreign ministry was appearing at this conference, conferring legitimacy on it, and they dismissed us. Amnesty International was called, and they dismissed us too. And so they really can't say that they didn't know. But what we've done here with this investigation is, for the first time, revealed, the Norwegian press hasn't been able to do this after years of investigation, revealed the funders of Thor Halvorsen and the Human Rights Foundation, and shown their connection, not just to the international Islamophobia industry, but to the figures who radicalized Anders Breivik. And I really think this is a huge scandal that is just beginning to unfold.
Max, what has been the reaction so far to this expose on the Oslo Freedom Forum and the figures behind it?
These are people who are really experienced. The people who put on the Oslo Freedom Forum are very experienced in PR, in publicity, in using social media. They're very powerful. They have a vast network. And their response has been pathetic. It's been almost nothing. A series of insults directed at me and Ali Abu Nima, and really nothing else, because they are unable to challenge a single fact that we've reported. And this two-part investigation spans almost 9,000 words. We just relied on solid facts. And I think that slowly but surely the Norwegian press is beginning to pick up on it. Klassekampen, which is the major left-wing daily in Oslo, has covered our reporting, and they grilled Thor Halvorsen about it. And his response was, well, I'll take money from anyone as long as they give me the money unconditionally. But ironically, he's attacked people in the past, like Danny Glover, for example, for taking funding for two films he had in development from the Venezuelan government. So it's hypocrisy on his part. And I think what he really wants to do, and what the American Islamic Congress wants to do, and what Free Arabs wants to do, is kind of duck and cover, and hope that, you know, that they're just powerful enough and their funders are reliable enough that they can weather the storm. And, you know, while they might be right, we're going to continue to expose these people and, you know, just let the public judge. I think in the case of the Oslo Freedom Forum, the Norwegian public really should have a right to have a say, because they're paying for this. They're paying for this guy's operation. The Norwegian government is kicking in lots of money, over $100,000 a year, for him to put on this whitewashing festival. And so, you know, it's really up to them to have a say, and it's up to the American public, because the State Department is kicking in hundreds of thousands of dollars of grants to the American Islamic Congress, a group that promoted the war on Iraq, to do things that we don't even understand. Nobody knows what they're doing. They have an office in Tunis and they have an office in Cairo, and we don't know what they're doing there, and that's our tax money.
All right, well, we're going to leave it right there. For much more on this story, you can read Max Blumenthal's articles on electronicintifada.net. Max, as always, thank you so much for all of your work and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The Electronic Intifada reported last week that Professor Stephen Hawking, legendary physicist and scholar, pulled out of next month's Facing Tomorrow conference in Israel in solidarity with the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. When the UK Guardian reported that Stephen Hawking had pulled out of the conference, it made headlines around the world. Hawking's decision was first announced by BRICUP, the UK campaign for the academic boycott of Israel. The Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima noted that, quote, given his stature, this was as much a victory for the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement as it was a major blow to Israeli prestige and propaganda, especially since the conference in question is hosted by Israeli President Shimon Peres. Our report noted that shortly after the announcement was made, a contradictory report was circulated by the pro-Israel website The Commentator, claiming that Hawking's withdrawal was for health reasons and had nothing to do with the boycott. However, within hours, Hawking reiterated his reasons for pulling out of the conference, noting that he had indeed made his decision in solidarity with Palestinians. In his own words, Professor Stephen Hawking said to the conference organizers, quote, I have received a number of emails from Palestinian academics. They are unanimous that I should respect the boycott. In view of this, I must withdraw from the conference. Had I attended, I would have stated my opinion that the policy of the present Israeli government is likely to lead to disaster. Related to this story, this week it was revealed that the University of California president, Mark Yudof, is scheduled to speak at the same conference Stephen Hawking boycotted. Yudof will be part of a conference panel regarding the, quote, delegitimization of Israel on the campus, and will be joined by high-level officials of Zionist organizations, including Birthright Israel and the Jewish Agency. For more on the significance of Yudof's participation in the conference, read our contributor Abraham Greenhouse's post in our Activism and BDS blog. In other news, the Student Senate at Oberlin College in Ohio recently voted in favor of a divestment resolution targeting six companies which profit from Israel's occupation, including companies in the settlement industry such as SodaStream and the British-Danish security firm G4S, which provides services to Israel's checkpoints and prison system. The resolution was supported by a wide variety of student groups on campus. In a press release sent to the Electronic Intifada, Lucia Kalinowski of Oberlin Students for a Free Palestine stated, quote, we are thrilled that this resolution has passed. We're proud that our Senate has decided to stand on the side of justice. The press release adds, quote, this is a major milestone in Students for a Free Palestine's Oberlin Divest campaign, which follows the principles of the 2005 Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Next semester, Students for a Free Palestine will take their resolution to the Oberlin College Board of Trustees Finance Committee, which will determine if Oberlin adopts the financial policies outlined in the resolution. Oberlin College is the latest university in North America to hold or pass such a resolution in the Student Senate during the 2012 to 2013 school year. In California alone, student senates at the University of California at Irvine, UC Riverside, UC San Diego, UC Santa Barbara, and UC Berkeley have all held divestment votes. The Undergraduate Student Union at York University in Toronto, Canada, passed a divestment resolution in March. For much more on this story, or to read our latest BDS roundup and other current news from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, check out our Activism and BDS blog on electronicintifada.net. The Electronic Intifada has published several videos and testimonies highlighting the 65th commemoration of the Nakba, the expulsion and exile of indigenous Palestinians from Palestine when Israel established itself as a state in May 1948. Today, the Nakba is ongoing as Palestinians continue to be forcibly displaced from their homes and land by the Israeli military and government. On Wednesday, May 15th, Nakba Day, New York-based poet and activist Remy Kanazi debuted a moving new poem entitled Nakba. In an email to the Electronic Intifada, Kanazi said the poem is an intimate piece that focuses on the dispossession of my grandmother in 1948 and some of the realities the Nakba produced. We posted his poem on the Electronic Intifada. Here's Remy Kanazi with Nakba.
She was scared. 7 months pregnant. Guns pointed at temples. Tears dropping. Stomach cusp back bent. Dirt pathways leading to dispossession. Rocking boats. Waves crashing. People rushing. Falling over each other. Packing into small spaces. Like memories. Her home. Mandated, occupied, cleansed, conquered, terrorizer sat on hills sniping children, neighbors fled on April 10th. Word came of massacre. They stayed, didn't fight, didn't flee, shells and bombs bursting in air like anthems, prayed for the dead, with priests and imams, prayed for the living, looking over shoulders for the Ergun and Haganah. She's a warrior, raised life, planted trees, painted fruit, as if the road was her garden, orphaned twice, had birth from Palestine, whispered Yaffa till final breath, never knew essence until she found emptiness, 48 ways to flee, and she found Beirut. Bullet holes in buildings, reminder of home, but not home. Years later, daughter sat on hills in the south, dreaming of breaking water never touched, thinks of their mother, that warrior, how battles still rage here and abroad, orchards flourished, propagandists called them barons, land expropriated for Europeans who called religion ethnicity, not native, not from here, plant flags, call it home, rename cities and villages, wiping, cleaning, cleansing memory that this is not theirs. Passed away August 22nd, 2009. Frail hands shook, lip trembled, didn't want to die, but suffered decades. She will speak Arabic, broken English, wounded words and murmurs, her eyes close, but every so often they blink brilliance. Memories that cannot be erased, uprooted, or stolen, she has not forgotten. We have not forgotten. We will not forget. Veins like roots of olive trees, we will return. That is not a threat, not a wish, a hope, or a dream, but a promise.
That was poet and activist Remy Kanazi. For more on his work, visit poeticinjustice.net. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out our newest features and op-eds, including Jamal Juma's op-ed, Porto Alegre is Palestine's Friend, So Why Has It Embraced Israel's War Industry? And a Dutch probe sends a warning to firms abetting Israel's crimes. FBI files reveal the Anti-Defamation League spied on Arab students. In Photos, revisiting the survivors of Israel's November assault on Gaza. Plus, from Al-Araqib to Susia, Palestinians highlight Israel's ongoing efforts to expel them, and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.